It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Keweenaw Peninsula in Michigan's Upper Peninsula is home to breathtaking wild beauty, and it also once contained rich veins of copper, which gave it the name Copper Country. The copper is long gone, but the waste products from mining remain. Sediment from ore processing operations in one part of the Keweenaw is threatening the wildlife and economies of the area of the former Mohawk mine, even 86 years after it closed. We're going to talk about the history of this waste, the consequences of its presence, and the proposed solutions to the problem. Have you ever traveled to the Keweenaw Peninsula or Grand Traverse Bay of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? What was your experience? Have you seen the black sand beaches? Are you concerned about mining operations in the Lake Superior Basin or other bodies of water? What questions do you have about the environmental impact of all this? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Phil Schneeberger is a fisheries biologist and the Lake Superior Basin Coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Phil, good morning. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning, John. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about the history of this ore processing waste from the old Mohawk mine. Explain the process that created this sediment.
Right. As you mentioned, it happened quite a while ago. It was between 1850 and 1929 that the major mining operations were in progress. And there were on the Keweenaw Peninsula over 140 mines that were working this copper load. And along with that were 40 mills which processed the ores. And this is the key factor because the ores had just big rocks that had to be crushed by huge steam-driven stamps. If you've ever been in the Keweenaw, as you mentioned to your listeners, you can still see some of those huge stamps that are big pile drivers. They come down and they crush the rock. And from that, then, the copper can be separated from the rest of the rock. And the key thing is that only 1% of that ore body contains copper. So 99% is waste. And those tailings are what the problem is because they were sluiced to different locations, including the one we're mainly talking about near Gay, Michigan, on the east side of the Keweenaw Peninsula. And just huge quantities of this waste material piled up and now is eroding into the lake, along the shoreline, into the harbor, and very critically covering a very important and productive reef, which has lake trout and whitefish, lake whitefish spawning, and nursery areas that is very important to the tribal community and the rest of the community as well.
So what's in these stamp sands? What is the makeup of this waste?
Well, a lot of it is just rock, but it does have higher levels of copper. When the copper is extracted, they get as much as they can, but there is some left over. You're not getting 100%, so it's a higher concentration than normally would be found, and copper does have some toxic properties to biological systems.
Okay, so the stamp sands that they came from the mill. The mill was located in Gay, Michigan. How far has this waste traveled to become the problem that it is today?
Yes. So in that 100 and plus years, it has traveled 5 miles down current from that location, and it has covered the beach, extensive beach areas, but more critically for, again, the fisheries and the biology of the lake. It's covered about 1,300 acres of nearshore coastal habitat.
We're talking about an area known as Buffalo Reef in Lake Superior. Tell us about Buffalo Reef, what it's like, and how it functions in the local ecosystem without the interference of the stamp sands.
Right. The fish that we're talking about and are most interested in are the lake trout and the lake whitefish, and they like cobble bedrock substrate. They lay their eggs in that substrate, and the spaces between the rocks helps protect the eggs and as well as the small fish when they hatch. So the reef itself is 2,200 acres. It's very big. And so just by size alone, it's very important for this area and, for area way beyond the reef. And the stamp sands are encroaching on the reef. It was somewhat protected over these years because there was a big trough that was in between where the original pile is and the reef. And that trough had to be filled before it could be overtopped, and then those sands continue in their march, if you will, toward the reef. But now the reef is being covered up to, we estimate, 30% of it is covered already. And the harm that it does, not only the toxic properties that I mentioned before, but just physically, when those sands cover the rock and they basically smother those spaces between the rocks where the fish would normally be laying their eggs.
We're talking with Phil Schneeberger, fisheries biologist and the Lake Superior Basin coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, about what's happening with stamp sands and the Buffalo Reef area in Lake Superior, which is this reef is just off the Keweenaw Peninsula in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But of course, the lake borders on several states and several provinces in Canada as well. So this is a big deal for Lake Superior. The mines closed 86 years ago. We can assume that the practices of the day were thought to be adequate, and so it's not like we can go back and say you should have done this differently. But going forward, though, we're going to have to find some way around this, I would think. And we'll get to that. What I'm interested in now is what our listeners might think of all of this. Have you traveled to the Keweenaw or the Grand Traverse Bay area of Upper Michigan? Tell us about your experience there. Have you seen the black sand beaches? Are you concerned about what's been happening there with the stamp sands and Buffalo Reef? Maybe you weren't aware of it before this morning, and you have some questions for our guest. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. When we come back, we'll ask Phil Schneeberger about the impact of all of this on the local economy, which fishing is part of that, so is tourism. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Sediment from mining operations in Upper Michigan is threatening the wildlife in Lake Superior and surrounding communities' economy, even 86 years after the close of the Mohawk Mine, just one of hundreds of copper mines in the Keweenaw area of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We're talking about the history of the waste and the consequences to the present day. Also, before we get to the end of this discussion, I want to talk about what the proposed solutions are. Have you traveled to the Keweenaw or Grand Traverse Bay area of Upper Michigan? What was your experience? Are you concerned about mining operations on Lake Superior or other bodies of water? What questions do you have about the environmental impact to the Buffalo Reef area from these stamp sands? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Phil Schneeberger is welcome, is with us. He's a fisheries biologist and the Lake Superior Basin Coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Phil, let's talk about the impact of all of this on the local economy. You talked about the impact to the fish. A lot of people rely on that fish, and the Keweenaw is a big tourist area in the UP. So what's the effect? What's the impact here?
Yes, the fish is where I think about mostly, since I'm a fish biologist. But like you said, the tourism, there are local residents there, of course, right along that shore that's being filled in by the stamp sands. There were natural white beaches along there that are now the black stamp sands. There's also Grand Traverse Bay Harbor, which is right at that about five mile extent down from the original pile, and where I mentioned that the sands have arrived to already. That harbor is being overtopped and clogged, and we've had to do some maintenance dredging. So all of the boating that comes out of that harbor is affected, and that includes the fishing vessels that come out of there. And it also is a very important harbor of refuge, without many others in the in the area. That so it's very important safety-wise. Local economy, as you know, there are always trickle-down effects for all of these things. So the fisheries, for example, it's not just the fishermen that are affected, but the wholesalers, the restaurants, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
go ahead.
Well, we started to get some callers here. I want to make sure we get to those before we run out of time. Matt joins us from Merrimack. Matt, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I was curious on the yardage of material that it would take to clean up the problem, or tons, that aspect, I guess.
Yeah. The figure, the mining waste, the original pile, is 22.7 million metric tons. And I don't know how easy that is to envision. Another way of looking at it is 16 million cubic yards. And then in terms of acres, it's like close to 3,000 acres.
I saw one description in an article I read in preparing for the program that it's enough to fill more than 1.4 million commercial dump trucks.
Right. And that gives you an idea of how difficult it is going to be to try to deal with it, because, filling those dump trucks and then the cost of transportation and the difficulty of placing it somewhere, because it is the material that it is. You just can't.
Well, that's actually a huge problem. I mean, okay, so let's say that we could pick up all of this stuff and get it away from Buffalo Reef, for example, if we could get it out of the lake, and I'm assuming that that's a challenge as well, but where would we put it? Where can this stuff be safely stored?
And those are the things that are being looked at right now. There's a task force group that was formed, and that's multi-agency with federal, state, tribal, local, many entities involved, and then a steering committee that just recently has published, or actually it might not be published, but it was presented at a public meeting and will soon be published, with some possible options, trying at the start to just brainstorm and come up with as many possible solutions as could be thought of. And then the idea is to narrow those down into 2, 3, or 4 that are the most viable and try to develop those further.
So Lake Superior is a really large body of water. Talk about how pollution in one area of the lake can have an effect in another.
Yes. So as you mentioned, there were hundreds of copper mines, hundreds of waste deposits around the Keweenaw Peninsula. Researcher at Michigan Tech University, Dr. Charlie Kerfoot, has looked at just the copper concentrations out in the water surrounding the Keweenaw Peninsula, and has published a paper back in 2004 showing that copper, he calls it a copper halo that surrounds Keweenaw Peninsula, and at measurable concentrations, it goes all the way to the Canadian shore.
Hmm, gee whiz. So what solutions are we looking at to either to clean up the waste or deal with the effects, and are those two different things?
I'd say they're very much connected, and they're also connected with your previous question about the effect on local economy, but the other side of the economy is the cost of dealing with it, and we've kind of alluded to that, you know, just the difficulty of dealing with these deposits that are out in the water, and then what do you do with them? So the figure that's been thrown out there is if we were to try to deal with the whole deposit, it would be in the neighborhood of $500 million. So when that kind of money is being put out there, as I said, we tried to look at all the different possibilities, including not doing anything, because, you know, before you put money out like that, you got to figure what can you do, what are you getting for that money, and is it worth it? So all the way from not doing anything, what would the economic and long-lasting environmental effects be, to dredging everything, different disposal site options, and then even stocking the fishery to replace the production that's lost on the reef, and also looking at something like building a different reef in the area that wouldn't be affected by the stamp sands that could...
Realistically, how long does Buffalo Reef have before it's completely overtaken by the stamp sands?
I would think, let's see, so it's about 35% covered right now, and I think it would be another 50 years or so before the reef would be completely covered.
But its effectiveness diminishes every time another acre is covered, and pretty soon the fish that have been spawning there won't have any place to do that. They'll have to either go somewhere else or die off, correct?
That's our belief, but we don't have good measurement of that. So we know that you would just expect that the more that it gets covered, the less that production is going to be used, but we don't know in detail how much of the reef is used by fish, so those are some of the questions that we want to try to get better knowledge of going forward, again, to have a better idea of what options are best served here.
So very quickly, we have less than a minute left. If a new mine or processing plant were to open today in the UP, it would be operating under completely different rules. Could we see this kind of thing happen again?
No, we couldn't. This is a legacy problem that is just from the past mining practices, and no, we won't see this again.
All right, then. That's, I think, where we can leave this. Phil Schneeberger, fisheries biologist and Lake Superior Basin coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, thank you, Phil, for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, and I appreciate your interest.
Coming up on the morning show, we will consider the increase in vaping among teenagers in one Wisconsin county, where now almost one in five teens reports having vaped in the last month. We'll talk about that with our guest and with you coming up on the morning show on the Ideas Network. Stay tuned. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The head of the Federal Food and Drug Administration has called vaping among teens a national epidemic. Closer to home, nearly one in five Dane County high school students reported having vaped in the last month. That's an increase from just a few years ago. What are schools and retailers doing about it is the question we'll try to answer this morning. School administrators, teachers, nurses, how popular are e-cigarettes among students at your schools? What have you done to try to tamp down e-cigarette use? And has it worked? Have you seen any kids turn into actual cigarette smokers after starting out with these e-cigarettes? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nina Gregerson is a health education coordinator with Public Health Madison, Dane County. She focuses on tobacco and nicotine control policies that affect youth. She performs education and outreach with the Tobacco-Free Columbia Dane County Coalition. Nina, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
The Food and Drug Administration recently called e-cigarette use among youth a national epidemic. Why is this such a big concern?
Yeah, so e-cigarette use has been on the incline for the last 5 years, and specifically among our young people. So I think the FDA has taken steps and has realized that these products are really becoming a problem among young people and are increasing in popularity, quite frankly. So they're just taking steps to ensure that we can address this issue and make it so young people don't see these products as harmless or see them as popular items.
What is the attraction here?
Yeah, so what we hear here locally in Dane County is that these products come in a variety of kid-friendly flavors. Kids really do see them as harmless. They don't see them as dangerous as cigarettes. And they come in a variety of shapes and sizes. So we're seeing e-cigarettes that have now transformed and now look like USB flash drives.
And those are called Juuls. That's J-U-U-L. It's an e-cigarette that's really struck a chord with high schoolers. In addition to its shape, how is this different than any other e-cigarette?
Yeah, so what we're seeing with Juuls are that they come in a much higher nicotine strength. So Juul pods have the nicotine liquid in them, and the content is 59 milligrams per milliliter, and that is much higher than any other e-cigarette product out there today. And in fact, one Juul pod is equivalent to one pack of cigarettes worth of nicotine.
So there's been an upsurge in usage among high school students in Dane County. What have the schools been trying to do to curb the problem?
Yeah, so we are doing active outreach to the schools here in Dane County to just increase awareness by school staff about what these products look like and why we're concerned with them. A lot of teachers have been telling me that they don't even know how to identify when kids are using these products. We do hear that kids are using them in class and not getting caught. So it's really just doing that educational piece to increase awareness, identify when kids are using the products, and really just increasing the knowledge of our school staff.
And I understand that the Juuls are a little different than regular vaping pens. They don't emit as much vapor, so it's a lot harder to see?
Correct. So as you would see with like a mod e-cigarette or even vape pens, those are you're going to exhale a much bigger cloud of vapor aerosol versus a Juul, which doesn't create that much aerosol when you exhale. So you're correct. So they can blow the vape into like their sweatshirt and you don't even know that they're vaping anything.
In May, you surveyed people who worked at middle schools and high schools around Dane County. Everyone said they wanted more training and resources to address this problem. How are you and your colleagues helping them in this?
Yeah, so like I said, we're actively reaching out to the schools who have responded to our survey to provide them with the resources, training, student curriculum, as well as updated tobacco policy for their schools, just to increase, again, the knowledge, awareness around these products, as well as providing teachers with tools to talk to kids about them as well.
So how are high school officials taught to spot someone who's vaping or Juuling?
Yeah, I think the number one sign would be in classes. If you see a student with their mouth over their sweatshirt or inside of their sweatshirt or inside of the sleeve, that could be your first sign that a kid is using a vape product in class. But another thing that's really becoming popular is Juuling in bathrooms, and kids are calling bathrooms Juul rooms now. So of course, we don't want to monitor bathrooms because of privacy issues, but I think it's important to increase awareness that kids are using the bathrooms to Juul specifically.
Well, let's talk about you mentioned that the Juuls had a higher concentration of nicotine than regular vaping pens, but they both administer what is the key drug that is contained in tobacco. And it's so why people smoke. And nicotine is according to what research shows us, highly addictive. How are we dealing with this issue with teenagers who use this nicotine regularly?
Yeah, you're totally correct. So the main component of these e-cigarette products is nicotine, and we do know that nicotine is one of the most addictive drugs out there. And it should be noted that we don't want our young people to be using nicotine products because it can disrupt proper brain development in young people, and we know that young people's brains continue to develop until they're age 25. But e-cigarettes also include other ingredients that a lot of people don't realize. So they do contain cancer-causing chemicals such as formaldehyde, and then they also have a lot of heavy metals such as nickel, tin, and lead.
So can we draw a line between the use of these vape pens and Juuls and eventual conversion to smoking? Is that something that's going to happen?
Yeah, so I think there is evidence out there to suggest that kids who use e-cigarette products who have never smoked a cigarette in their life are more likely to switch to conventional cigarettes in the future. So there is some initial research out there to make that link, which is very concerning for us in public health.
Now, it's illegal to sell this material to people under 18, I understand, and over the years, stores around Dane County have received fines for selling e-cigarettes to minors. How have the stores reacted to the uptick in underage interest in these devices?
Yeah, so we were able to start checking vape shops and other establishments who sell e-cigarette products in 2015 for compliance purposes. And when we first started checking compliance for e-cigarette sales, we did see actually a a large percentage of folks selling those products. And, you know, anecdotally talking to clerks who were selling, a lot of them didn't realize that they had to check IDs. So we have been doing, as the coalition, active outreach to vape shops specifically to address the issue of compliance, increase their knowledge that they should be checking IDs for these products, and really encouraging them to train their staff to check an ID and to know the consequences of selling nicotine products to young people.
Are state and local lawmakers getting into this as well? Is there anything being done on that front to address the underage use of e-cigarettes?
Not here locally in Wisconsin, unfortunately, but with the FDA coming out and addressing these products and saying that there is an epidemic of youth use of these products, I think that will start a national conversation about young people's use of e-cigarettes and nicotine products. So I really hope that states around the nation, including ours, really do take that seriously and start talking about policies to address youth use.
What about parents? What should parents be doing here?
I think overall, parents should just become informed. Again, like educators, I've talked to a lot of parents who don't even know what a Juul is. So I think just being aware of what these products are, what they look like, and having an honest conversation with your kids about the dangers of these products and how you could potentially become a cigarette smoker if you begin using these products as a young person.
What about the role of students in helping each other avoid these products? I mean, they seem pretty cool now. Is there a way to make them uncool, kind of the way we tried to do with cigarettes?
Yeah, I think teens could play a huge role in our prevention efforts. And luckily for us, we do have youth prevention groups called FACT, and they really do peer-to-peer education and encourage their peers not to use these products. And we have a solid group in Oregon, Wisconsin, as well as Lodi, Wisconsin, and they're doing a lot of work in their local communities as well as their high schools to inform their peers around these products and encouraging their fellow high school students to not use.
So moving forward, what's your hope? What are you hoping happens here?
I really hope that people become aware and realize that these products are not safe, and that hopefully one day we will see the same social norms around these products as we do with cigarettes, because we don't want our young people to be the next generation hooked on nicotine and tobacco products.
Nina Gregerson, Health Education Coordinator with Public Health Madison-Dane County, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
Nina's focused on tobacco and nicotine control policies that affect youth. She performs education and outreach with the Tobacco-Free Columbia-Dane County Coalition. Coming up, we learn more about an all-abilities park in La Crosse. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A unique and inclusive park is coming to La Crosse. Construction is underway to turn Train Park into an all-abilities park, where individuals of all ages who have cognitive, sensory, or other physical challenges can safely play. When finished, it'll be the first of its kind in the state. We talk with the president of the project about the need for such a space in La Crosse, as well as what an all-abilities park looks like. Fran Formanek is president of the All Abilities Train Park Project. Fran, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning, John. Thank you for inviting us to be on.
Well, first of all, can you describe what an All Abilities Park is?
Well, one of the things that it's not is putting a bunch of playground equipment in one little area and then letting people that have some type of disability utilize it. In this case, our park is very unique in that it's made up very much like a Disney World kind of theme way that there'll be about seven different zones in it. Each one of them have a different specialty kind of thing for the children to play on. For example, there'll be sliding zone, a swinging zone. We're going to have a zip line zone. We'll have youth and theater along with that. So it's a very unique situation that we've decided to go with. There's very few of them in the world, much less in the United States. Especially in our region, there is none that is going to compare to this beautiful park.
Now, I can understand including playground equipment that's accessible to an individual in a wheelchair, for example. But this concept also takes into account individuals with cognitive or sensory challenges. So what are the big differences between an ADA-compliant park and an all-abilities park?
Well, one of the biggest parts with the especially the autistic children is that they have a tendency sometimes to have a fight-or-flight kind of situation. This project was actually born about 7 years ago by a number of parents that had autistic children or have autistic children, and they didn't have anywhere to go because every so often the children would take off and they couldn't control them. And so they ended up taking them down to a dog park because it was fenced in. And so when you look at the park that we're putting together, every piece of equipment is made so that, like you said, anybody with autism or in that spectrum or anybody that is disability of any kind can utilize that equipment. And so this park is so much different than just an ADA park. Our park director, Steve Caroline, when he first got involved in it, he said, well, all of my parks are ADA compliant. Well, that's true. But the parks that we're putting together here, this park, is so much different because it gives the ability for people with disabilities, autism, and those that are wheelchair-bound to be able to utilize this equipment more so than the equipment that is an ADA park. An ADA park basically amounts to that, you know, a person can go into the park, but in reality, a lot of the equipment that's in there cannot be used by that individual. And that's the difference between our park and the ADA park. Our equipment is specially made, some of it costing as much as $25,000 to be able to be used for people with disabilities of any kind.
So how do you ensure safety in a park like this?
Well, one of the things that obviously we're going to be utilizing the university and the technical school and the two hospitals as far as utilizing their employees that deal with people that have these disabilities. And they're actually going to be a teaching process involved in the park itself so that, you know, we have trained individuals that will be working with the children, but also, of course, their parents.
Once completed, this will be, as you mentioned, the only all-abilities park in Wisconsin and one of only a handful in the United States. Does that speak to the challenges in getting a park like this off the ground?
Absolutely. You know, again, we thought right off the bat that we would make this park something unusual as far as the region, in fact, the Midwest. About one of the only parks that we looked at is in California, called Magic Bridge, and we didn't design our park like that, but in a way we utilized some of the ideas. Our subcommittee on equipment has been working diligently for months on end, you know, tweaking this and changing that to a point where now we're at a point that we're going to be bidding it out as far as the park itself. Now, as you said before, we have had a groundbreaking, and that'll be the start of the buildings that are going to be utilized for the park itself. The park itself is sitting on about 2.7 acres of a part of the train park itself is about almost 7 acres itself. But on the part that we're going to be utilizing, it's about 2.7 acres for this fantastic park that we're putting together.
So what's the timeline? How soon could there be children playing in the new and improved train park?
Well, it sounds to me like we're looking more at the start of fall of 2019. We're going to be putting the bids out within the next month for the park itself. We just received a $1 million TIF funding from the city of La Crosse on Thursday, which has probably taken us up to almost $4 million on our goal of $6 million. So the bids are going out, and, you know, the building part will be taking place within the next couple of weeks as far as the start is concerned. But as far as the playground itself, we're looking at more at the fall of 2019.
I know this might be getting ahead of things a little bit, but do you hope to include more All Abilities parks in the La Crosse area?
Well, this park is so unique that was a question that one of the ladies that works at a place called Aptiv said, well, how come you can't do this at every park? Well, this is such a unique situation that it's going to be a centralized area throughout the city of La Crosse. And so right now, you know, we're focusing on just this one.
So have you heard about interest from other parts of the state about doing something else like this?
Absolutely. I'm hearing some things that they're talking about. I see in Wausau they're starting a project, something similar, not in the depth that we have. And there's a number of them that are started in Minnesota also, but they're not in the concept that we've got as far as our zones that we're putting together. They're more of a traditional kind of playground with all the equipment smashed in together in one little area kind of thing. So it's a little bit different.
So with the construction of this park, what kind of message are you hoping to send to the rest of the state and the rest of the country, for that matter, about the kind of place that La Crosse is?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we started out with, and we utilize that in our mission statement, is that, you know, this park is built for everybody, and it's designed to bring children, family, and loved ones of all ages and ability levels to enjoy the many benefits in outdoor play and recreation. And for the city of La Crosse, we feel like we're the leader, especially on the western part of the state of Wisconsin. But I think that this park is going to show not only Wisconsin, the Midwest, and the country, and that's how much we feel that this park is going to make a difference in the lives of many, many children, and that it just stands out so much. We feel it's going to be a big plus for employment, that if there's individuals that have children with autism or some kind of disability, that may be looking at the park and say, hey, we want to live in this kind of area. So it's a big plus. It really is.
Fran Fermanek, president of the All Abilities Train Park Project, thanks for joining us today and telling us about this thing.
Well, thank you. And also, you can find, we have a website, and just go to trainpark.com. And we also have a Facebook page there that really shows you everything about our project from the start to where we're at right now.
Got it. Thank you so much, Fran. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.